Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 748, update on the rewriting of the history of World War II. This program is being recorded on July 17th of the year 2011. At the end of Side 1, we were talking about not only the resignation of the German ex-ballet minister, Erika Steinbach, a member of Angela Merkel's political party. She had to resign after she basically made a statement blaming World War II on Poland. We were also looking at the associated Vertriebene groups and their agitation on behalf of a revision of the history of World War II, again, blaming the conflict initially on Poland, then on Britain's backing of Poland, and finally on basically the expansion of the war into the Pacific. We're going to, before we get back to Germany and the ongoing revision of world history by German power establishment, and including some of its more respected media outlets, such as the very estimable Spiegel publication, we're going to briefly revisit a very ominous element, something I haven't spoken about much in the recent past, but veteran listeners who listened during the 90s and the early part of the last decade heard me going on at considerable length about German corporate control over the American media and, in turn, the Bormann Capital Network, literally the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground, is the dominant element in that German corporate control over American media. Much of that discussion centered on the Bertelsmann Corporation. Bertelsmann, after its acquisition of the Random House Corporation, is now the largest English-language publisher with roughly double, maybe more than double the sales volume of the nearest English-language publisher. Bertelsmann was also the publisher for the SS in World War II. Heinrich Mohn was a member of the SS. That was the patron of the house, succeeded eventually by his son Reinhard. And lest people think that, well, you know, that was a long time ago, Dave, and it doesn't have anything to do with what's going on today and so forth, well, I would suggest examining the following. We're going to review an element that we've looked at in, among other programs, For the Record 298. This is an article by Hersch Fischler and John Friedman from The Nation of November 8th of 1999. It's called Bertelsmann's Revisionist. And in the book, there is discussion of Dirk Bavendam, last name B-A-V-E-N-D-A-M-M. Now, Bavendam is the official house historian for Bertelsmann, the publisher for the SS in World War II, and the largest English language publisher. And Bavendam has some very, very interesting interpretations of World War II. Again, this is the guy who was the house historian for the largest English language publisher, which not incidentally was the publisher for the SS. How does he interpret World War II? Well, that is an interesting question. We find the following of Bavendam, the author's right. His book, Roosevelt's Way to War, Roosevelt's Weg zum Krieg, was published in 1983. Rewriting history, he stated that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, not Adolf Hitler, had caused World War II. He also wrote that American Jews controlled most of the media, unquote, and he claimed they gave a false picture of Hitler. Did the book impress Heinrich's son Reinhard Mohn, then the majority shareholder of Bertelsmann? The firm hired Bavendam as its house historian, and in 1984, he completed an historical study, 150 Years of Bertelsmann, the Founders and Their Time, with a foreword by Mohn. Skipping down, by the way, he pretty much exonerated the Mohn family of collaboration with the Nazis. And in fact, not surprisingly, Bavendam claimed that they had resisted the Nazis. Nothing could be further from the truth. It was not only Bertelsmann was not only the largest supplier of books to the German army, it was the official publisher for the SS. And lest people think that Dirk Bavendam has changed his stripes, more about his publishing efforts. Again, the house historian for Bertelsmann. In a second book, Roosevelt's War, published in 1993 and reissued in 1998, Bavendam accuses Roosevelt of enacting a plan to start World War II. In the same book, he suggests that Hitler's threats in early 1939 against European Jewry were a reaction to Roosevelt's strategy against Germany. After the revelations about Bertelsmann's Nazi past appeared, the company announced that it had asked, quote, the historian and publicist Dr. Dirk Bavendam to look at the new information and begin to reinvestigate the role the publishing house played in those days. So again, the official house historian of the largest English-language publisher is blaming World War II on Franklin Delano Roosevelt and, of course, the Jews. More about the strategy that I believe is at work with this historical revisionism. So as we're looking at the Vertriebene groups shifting the blame for World War II, it'll be interesting to see how long it will be before Franklin Roosevelt has the blame for World War II hung on him. That's part, I believe, and I think that there are powerful elements, the same elements in this country, obviously not the same individuals because they've passed on, but the same corporate elements in this country that sought to get rid of Franklin Roosevelt in the 1934 coup attempt are now, through the Republican Party and the Tea Party, feverishly working to undo the New Deal. And I think part of the tarnishing, the deliberate tarnishing of Franklin Roosevelt's legacy is the shifting of blame for World War II onto Franklin Delano Roosevelt. X number of years down the line, it'll probably be said that the victims of the rape of Nanking and Auschwitz basically were accident-prone. Remember that powerful elements are behind this deliberate rewriting of history. Once again, relations between Poland and Germany remain strained because the willingness on the part of powerful German elements to revise the history of World War II, such as former Ministry of Expellee Erika Steinbach's claim that Poland, not Germany, started World War II. One of the reasons why this agitation goes on is that the Vertriebene groups, again, are not only linked at one level to the SS, which went underground at World War II, but they continue to wield considerable influence within the Deutsche Burschenschaften, the right-wing political fraternities that in turn act as conduits to many of the German and also Austrian ministries. In another article from the very important GermanForeignPolicy.com newsletter, which feeds along the bottom of the front page of the SpitfireList.com website, the following article is called Fraternity Brothers, Questionable Polish Borders. It's from January 19th of 2010, and it reads in part as follows. The German Minister of Transportation, Peter Ramsauer of the CSU, is a member of a student fraternity that has ties to circles of the right-extremist National Democratic Party of Germany, or NPD. The umbrella fraternity Deutsche Burschenschaft, or DB, not only has Minister Ramsauer as a member, but also two NPD members of regional parliaments. The alleged historical merits of Nazi criminals Hess and Hitler are debated in the DB's newspapers. The fraternity, in which Ramsauer is referred to as a fraternity brother, places Poland's territorial integrity into question. In the next few weeks, Transportation Minister Ramsauer is due to reach a decision concerning Nazi victims in Poland who are demanding reparations from his ministry for damages incurred during the Nazi deportation carried out with the Deutsche Reichsbahn, the German state railroad, in World War II. Cabinet member Ramsauer is not alone. Hans-Peter Uhl is also a member of a fraternity with NPD ties. Uhl is the spokesperson for domestic affairs of the conservative CDU-CSU parliamentary caucus in the German parliament, or Bundestag. Legislation concerning the surveillance of the country's right-wing extremists is among Uhl's functions. One more time, because he's the fellow who's in charge with surveilling right-wing extremists in Germany, and he's tied to the very same elements. In the book, in our interviews with Martin Lee, the author of the book, The Beast Reawakens, we took a look at the fact that Edward Lindner, I believe his formal title was Deputy Interior Minister. In any event, he was a previous minister in charge with overseeing the containment, I should say, of right-wing extremists, and he himself was a member of the Süddeutsche Landsmannschaft, a member of the Vertriebene groups. Just exactly the same thing is true of Peter Uhl, last name U-H-L. Again, legislation concerning the surveillance of the country's right-wing extremists is among Uhl's functions. Within the spectrum of the German cabinet, Ramsauer advocates far right-wing political standpoints. His political mentor is Otto Wieschau of the CSU, who until recently was a member of the Presidium of the Deutsche Bahn AG. DBAG is the German railroad in charge of political relations. As supervising minister in charge of the DBAG, Ramsauer is continuing Wieschauer's work. And again, those Nazi-linked, NPD-linked German ministers are calling into question, in addition to their being in a position to rule definitively on the potential economic liability of the German railroad for some of the Nazi excesses, the same clique is basically attempting to revise the borders of contemporary Germany and contemporary Poland. And talking about the Deutsche Burschenschaft, the DB is ethnically oriented. According to its constitutional principles, it is committed to the free development of German ethnic identity and close fellowship with all sectors of the German people, regardless of national borders. In the DB manual, one reads that by Germany, we mean the region in Central Europe inhabited by Germans, including the regions from which Germans were illegally expelled, unquote. They maintain that an orientation of the fatherland concept of the state is only of relative significance because of the brevity and impermanence of states themselves. In the, quote, manual, unquote, the consequence is explained with an explanation of international law regarding the November 4, 1990 Polish-German border agreement. According to this argumentation, Poland merely has a right to tolerated use, unquote, of its own western territories, the Oder-Neisse region, which possibly, again quoting, which possibly represents a sort of territorial sovereignty, unquote, while simultaneously the territorial sovereignty over the eastern region continues to remain in Germany's hands. The point being that the Deutsche Burschenschaft, to which some of the key German ministers who have various dealings vis-a-vis Poland belong, basically, they belong, they were members of the DB, and other members of the DB are associated with the German NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party. Basically, some of those ministers are some of the German ministers who are helping to formulate policy with regard to Poland, and obviously, ideologically, they are at one with the Nazi viewpoint of Poland and the, quote, eastern territories, unquote, that were conquered by the Third Reich. The point that I'm making, and by the way, the GermanForeignPolicy.com newsletter is very important. It's not the easiest thing in the world to read because it, I believe, is translated from German. It's a very important source to use. The point that is being made here is that some of these formally revised interpretations of World War II, and some of those revised interpretations of World War II which have implications for contemporary policy are being advanced because of the fact that key people within the German government are linked to some of the elements that helped to, well, ultimately, if you go back far enough, spawn the Third Reich, but that are advocate, that are active fire carriers, so to speak, for contemporary German fascism. And one of the most striking examples of the rewriting of German history, and that concerns the proposal that was actually floated in Spiegel, or given positive treatment by Spiegel, a justifiably prestigious German publication, for basically a pro-Vertriebene Group revision of the history of Europe. And beyond that, there is the hint here of a second Nuremberg trial in order to try the crimes against the ethnic Germans. Basically, what we are seeing is a gradual turning of history on its head, with the victims of the Third Reich being labeled as aggressors, and with some of the collaborators of the Third Reich, notably the various ethnic German groups in parts of Europe that were invaded by the Nazis, largely as an excuse for, and under the excuse of liberating those areas from oppression of the German minorities, we are now seeing Spiegel advancing what is essentially a pan-Germanist and Nazi Ostpolitik, a pro-Third Reich and fundamentally revisionist viewpoint. By the way, in the books for download section of the Spitfire website, there are a number of good books about the Nazis' use of fifth column movements in Europe. One of the best is Armies of Spies by Joseph Gollum. The book was published in 1939, It is available for download for free, and it will give a good overview of the Nazis' use of fifth column movements among ethnic Germans in some of the countries that they had targeted for conquest. Now, again, just as we have seen the House historian for Bertelsmann blaming World War II on Franklin Roosevelt, here, basically, we are seeing the very estimable Der Spiegel advancing what is a Third Reich political viewpoint, a pan-Germanist Ostpolitik, if one will, vis-a-vis Eastern Europe, the retrievement of groups, the expulsion of the Germanic minorities at the end of World War II, and the entire pro-Nazi viewpoint that is being kept alive and in some cases implemented by the retrievement of groups and what I call the Underground Reich. GermanForeignPolicy.com of March 8th of 2011 had Nuremberg 2, and it reads in part as follows. The journal Der Spiegel takes a conspicuous position in an article dealing with the prospect of prosecuting so-called crimes of expulsion of Germans in the aftermath of World War II. According to this article, the expulsions, unquote, of Germans from East European countries in the immediate aftermath of the war are acts that are, quote, not all so different, unquote, from the crimes that have been prosecuted in The Hague before the International Tribunal for Yugoslavia since the 1990s. The fact that these acts were not handled by an international court subsequent to the Nuremberg trials that prosecuted the main Nazi war criminals has brought great displeasure to the West German population. It is therefore understandable, unquote, that, quote, many post-war Germans, especially among the resettled, have characterized the Nuremberg trial verdict's victor's justice that, quote, had not alleviated historical justice, but rather compounded it, unquote. Again, this is from Spiegel. This is not to be casually disregarded. More. As Der Spiegel explains, those crimes of expulsion, unquote, could still be prosecuted today by citing the precedents of Estonia. In 1994, the possibility of prosecuting certain crimes against humanity were written into Estonian penal law, even though the alleged crime had occurred in the distant past. Under this law, two men were convicted who in 1949 had participated in deporting civilians to Soviet labor camps, unquote. Note the revision of World War II history in Estonia with which we began the program. Continuing, the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg has subsequently ruled that these and other similar verdicts to be legally binding in spite of their being in violation of the prohibition on ex post facto laws. It would, quote, be difficult to deny, unquote, that also the expulsion of Germans under the current standards are clearly crimes against humanity, unquote. In light of the confirmation of the Estonian convictions by the European Court of Human Rights, the genie of Nuremberg, unquote, today is no longer to be kept in the bottle, unquote. What Estonia can do, others can do too, unquote. And again, bear in mind with the revising of World War II history in Estonia itself, with which we began the program. More about Der Spiegel's basically endorsement of a pro-Nazi, pro-Vertriebene group Ostpolitik and political viewpoint. Camouflaged as suggestive questions, Der Spiegel concludes with the suggestion that an international tribunal should be established to prosecute those who had committed the so-called crimes of expulsion against Germans, a Nuremberg II. This sort of tribunal could be based on, quote, an internationally binding treaty with the former nations of expulsion, meaning the countries of East and Southeast Europe. In the aftermath of World War II, they, on the legal basis of the Potsdam Agreements, had resettled German-speaking minorities who had been used as fifth columns by the Nazis to destabilize these countries to what became West Germany. The journal's case could be hinged on the fact that since 1949, every West German government has characterized this resettlement of Germans an injustice, which, in principle, should be prosecuted. Just last week, the German Bundestag voted in favor of declaring August 5th an annual commemoration day for the injustice of expulsion, unquote. Only a few years ago, this would have been considered just as unthinkable as the creation of a tribunal for the expelling countries, unquote. today. So again, basically, it isn't just the retrievement groups. It isn't just the Ministry for Ex-Ballet and people like the DB, the Deutsche Burschenschaft. It is also prestigious publications like Spiegel who are engaging in this wholesale revision of World War II history. Again, a good discussion of the use of fifth column movements by the Third Reich. Armies of Spies by Joseph Column, published in 1939 and available for download for free on the Spitfire website. A couple of examples of German unwillingness to address crimes of the Third Reich. In a GermanForeignPolicy.com article titled Useless Mouths from June 14th of 2011, we read the following. 70 years after the German invasion of the Soviet Union, the German federal government is still denying the existence of concentration camps run by the Wehrmacht. Over the past 4 years alone, the Republic of Belarus has repeatedly asked Berlin to recognize the Ozerici death camp that had been established by the Nazi army as a concentration camp. The German side has regularly rejected this request by referring to ambiguous judicial obstacles, unquote. The Wehrmacht established the Ozerici concentration camp in Marchlands in March of 1944, where relatives of slave laborers who had been deported to Germany were held captive in the open without shelter. The prisoners, most of whom were elderly, sick, or children, were considered unfit to work, unquote, and therefore deliberately exposed to death by starvation and cold. Under these circumstances, more than 9,000 people died in just 1 week. The German Army Command considered this a success. Quote, "We don't need to supply food to useless mouths," unquote, declared the Wehrmacht command responsible for the death camp. German historians have called this one of the worst crimes the Wehrmacht ever committed against civilians. However, the survivors of the Ozerici concentration camp have never received reparations for their suffering. According to information released by the Belarusian Justice Ministry 70 years after the German invasion of the Soviet Union, Germany is still refusing to recognize the Ozerici death camp, which had been erected by the Nazi military. More about this. This is from Permitted Under International Law. Again, more revising of the history of World War II. The German government is still refusing reparations to Soviet prisoners of war 70 years after the German invasion of the Soviet Union. This refusal is in spite of the fact that hundreds of thousands of Soviet soldiers were held in camps similar to concentration camps and were forced to do slave labor for German agricultural and industrial enterprises under deadly conditions. I would add a lot of them were used as human guinea pigs and deliberately killed. Continuing. Even though the Foundation Remembrance Responsibility in Future, founded by Berlin in 2000, envisioned reparations for surviving slave laborers, Red Army prisoners of war as well as Italian military detainees were excluded from the defined scope of application of this Foundation's Act. German courts have always dismissed lawsuits of reparation claims brought by surviving Soviet POWs with the argument that, quote, slave labor was permitted under international law. But that's an interesting one. Slave labor permitted under international law. I have to look that one up. Of course, I'm being facetious. An interesting development is beginning to take place. As veteran listeners to this program know, I view the so-called 9-1-1 truth movement with the most jaundiced of eyes. There, in fact, was a huge conspiracy behind September 11th beyond what we've been told, and there is, as a matter of course, documented complicity on the part of the Bush administration running through some of the Saudi corporate links and also through the Muslim Brotherhood and some of the elements that are allied with the GOP's ethnic outreach organization, and which also appear to have been used to help to support the anti-Soviet Afghan Mujahideen effort during the first Afghan war. However, the notion of the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center and so forth is not only physically impossible and readily verifiably false, but it is absolutely surreal. And it's so surreal, and particular listeners to the Pacifica Network are going to have a tough time with this one, the listeners down on KPFK in Los Angeles, because that stuff's been hyped the controlled demolition, that is, has been hyped 24-7 down there. One of the things that I noted, not only the ridiculousness of the claims, basically, the way in which the various nonsense claims feed into one another. The claim that, for example, the Twin Towers collapsed in their footprint. No, they didn't. A section of one of the towers taller than World Trade Center 7 itself laid out across World Trade Center Plaza devastated World Trade Center 6, basically leveled it to its foundation, something the truthers never talk about, and it ripped off a corner of World Trade Center 7 to the height of roughly 18 to 20 stories. But one of the things that I've noted, aside from the claims themselves by the truthers, and aside from the fact that they've played an essential role in the cover-up of September 11th by basically badjacketing the notion of government complicity in September 11th, that's exactly what they were supposed to do, too. But I've noted the smooth and almost seamless, almost effortless moving of Nazis and doctrinaire fascists into the 911 truth movement and their ready acceptance by people within the so-called progressive sector, or certainly people whose basic political instincts would be neither Nazi nor fascist. In this context, one of the better-known truthers, a former Marine named, actually ex-Marine named James Fetzer, has been something of a fellow traveler at some of the Holocaust revisionist forums, and he's been arguing that there should be open debate about the Holocaust, and I'm of two minds on that. I do think there should be open debate. On the other hand, many European countries, more cognizant of the real history of fascism, have made it a crime to deny the Holocaust because they are it is viewed as something along the lines of the shouting fire in a crowded theater. I don't think basically saying much of anything should ideally be banned by law. On the other hand, I have been waiting for the truthers to serve as a vehicle for the introduction of Holocaust denial. And apparently now Fetzer is helping to spur that dialogue, not denying the Holocaust, but by advocating that, in fact, there should be open debate about the same thing, which is about the Holocaust. And although, again, he's not a Holocaust denier, he has been lobbying somewhat to engage in open debate on same. I guess he's also been treated fairly harshly by some of the Holocaust deniers themselves. I will have a link to this in the printed description for this program. It is interesting. I want to make it clear that it's not that Fetzer is denying the Holocaust, but he is advocating open debate about it. And I'm wondering how long it's going to be before the truthers turn into Holocaust deniers. Certainly, they're, in a sense, they are already Holocaust deniers themselves. And in this regard, we're going to wrap this program up by talking about the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk. In that book, the Third Reich goes underground, builds up its economic muscle, and gains control of the opinion-forming media. And one of the ways, one of the goals of that is to revise the history of World War II. And that strategy is basically described as follows. About 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a super corporation that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. Not openly, not with bands and trumpets or swastikas flying, but quietly. One huge corporation cuddling up to one another and gently munching it up like a great gubbing amoeba. Since then, we've been replacing executives, pushing somebody out here, bringing somebody else in there. We've swung program content around, too. Not much, but a little, so it won't show. We've cut down on nasty Nazi movies, good guys in white hats and bad guys in black SS hats, lovable Jews versus fiendish Germans, and we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes. Yes, indeed, the history is being rewritten. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 748, update on the rewriting of the history of World War II. This program is being recorded on July 17th of the year 2011. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.